This summer, America turns 250 years old, and there's no better way to celebrate than getting outside and exploring this great nation. One way to do that is to rent a camper or RV from Outdoorsy. Outdoorsy is the most trusted RV rental marketplace in the U.S., making it easy for anyone over 21 to rent an RV or camper without owning one. With Outdoorsy, you can drive it yourself, tow it, or even have it delivered and fully set up at your destination. With comprehensive insurance, 24/7 customer support, and roadside assistance, Outdoorsy gives you the peace of mind you need when on the road. Outdoorsy is even the perfect option for your next out-of-state hunting or fishing trip. Right now, my listeners can have all service fees removed from their bookings in 2026 with code EMPIRE at Outdoorsy.com. That's Outdoorsy.com and use code EMPIRE at checkout to remove service fees. It's time to get outside and enjoy your summer. I've been trying Underbrush from Nathan & Sons, and it's not really regular gum. It's remineralizing chewing gum. Basically an oral care routine in gum form. You brush in the morning and at night, but after lunch, there's a big gap where most of us do nothing for our teeth. Underbrush is made for that moment. Chew it for 5 to 10 minutes, spit it out, and move on. Or keep chewing it if you like the feel of it. It's made with something called hydroxyapatite. That's the same mineral your enamel is made from, and natural saps like mastic and spruce. So it has a firmer, really satisfying chew. The company is only a few years old, and the team is literally making, packing, and shipping gum every day. So if you want a simple daily upgrade for your teeth, check out Underbrush from Nathan & Sons. Check them out today at nathanandsons.com. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands for the super athletic stuff, like running gear for cruising up the trail. Woo! And the super athletic-ish stuff, like fishing gear for chilling by the creek. Nice cast. Fitness apparel to push for higher reps. You got this. And golf balls priced so you can afford to lose one. Or a few. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
When you post hunting photos on Instagram, they get censored. When you post on Go Wild, you get virtual fist bumps from fellow hunters. When you buy gear on Amazon, you gas up a billionaire spaceship. When you buy gear on Go Wild, we donate to a camp that teaches kids to hunt, fish, and shoot. See the difference? Go Wild is a free social community built by hunters for hunters. Join today at downloadgowild.com, and I'll give you $10 just for setting up your account. And you'll keep unlocking Go Wild rewards as you share content, because guess what? We like hunting pictures. Join at downloadgowild.com or in the App Store.
Hey folks, wherever you're listening to this podcast right now, chances are your deer season is in full swing. Hopefully things are going well for you. And if you're one of the folks that took the time and preparation to plant some Real World Wildlife Products food plot blends, chances are you're having a great success. We here at Pro Talk Outdoors love our Real World products, whether it's the Clover Chicory Blend, Whitetail Harvest Salad, Deadly Dozen, the Gen 2 soybeans that are always a dynamite hit all the way through the season. Chances are, if you've got one of those plots out, you're having great success. If not, better luck next year, folks. Let's get them in. Go to realworldwildlifeproducts.com for more information on how you can improve your season.
That's what I call Pro Talk. Really don't know the answer, just make it up.
My rut is that I am in a rut.
get the pilot of Red Arrow going. Just really a way to skip class.
I want to say, hey, those boys right there are entertaining.
There you go. That's the nicest thing anybody's ever said on this podcast.
Alex Rutledge here with American Roots Outdoors TV.
Hey, this is Lee and Tiffany Lukowski from the Crest TV.
Hi, I'm Don Higgins.
This is Jeff Lindsay.
Hey, everybody, this is Mark Drury with Drury Outdoors.
Hey, this is Craig Fitz of Trained Assassins TV. You're listening to Dave and JP on Pro Talk Outdoors, the craziest two I know.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Pro Talk Outdoors. Sitting in Dave's new office here. This is quite appropriate. I mean, the theme is good in here for what we're doing.
I like my view. I do.
Absolutely.
I like my view. We got a big turkey here staring us down right here, kind of looking down on us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he probably should look down on us, the performance we've had in the recent turkey season.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. We got Rhino and the buck that the neighbors called Tank. I never really named that deer, you know.
Named him Food.
Yeah, he got it.
That's a stud. I mean, that's a deer of a lifetime for 90% of whitetail hunters.
It's a good one. It's a good one. And then this year's kill, which I never named that deer. I didn't know that deer exists. We can call him Weenie.
I know exactly why you're saying that too. the color here is awesome on that one. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, chocolate look to that. I mean, that's a pretty dark rack.
Yeah,
really.
He's chocolate horned, that's for sure. And he was a good deer.
Kind of a no bake cookie color.
You hungry?
No. Just ate. Actually, I'm good.
You want me to get Savannah in there baking us up something?
No, they're no bakes. You don't bake them.
Oh. Well, she can
whip some
up. Yeah, I don't know. I don't eat no baked cookies, man. I used to. Used to love them things. Give me heartburn back in the day.
Heartburn?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yep. Haven't had that in a long time, though. So, yeah, then we got the 3.5-pound crappie here on the wall.
Which is an absolute slab. When they say catching slabs, that's what they mean.
Yeah.
Right there.
Yep, absolutely.
Only most folks don't do that.
Well,
that's what they're hoping to go do.
Yeah, because everything we catch with the crappies, we pretty much eating them, too, so.
Yeah, that's an impressive fish as well. So, yeah, the theme in here is very nice. You're looking out. I see you need a bigger tarp for the tractor.
I need a building built out here for the tractor is what I really need. So
you might want to get in line.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people looking for buildings.
It's tough right now. So, yeah, man, but, we got a good view out here. What's going to be I got a 3.5-acre field here that I'm looking right out the window at, and – I think I have decided to go with the real world clover chicory mm-hmm. around the edges.
Sure.
And I'm going to put some soybeans the first year in the middle.
Yeah.
Give them a little bit of everything. So we've leased out the rights to the front and the backfield to get it farmed out. So that's going to be an ag this year. But this side field here, that's going to be our little playground.
That's going to be a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. And a lot of activity out there in that field. They seem to cross right there a lot.
Does this mean I get to bring my tractor and tiller over to help you till that up?
Absolutely.
That's going to be fun.
Absolutely, man. Yeah, we're gonna bust that ground up over there. But, you know, on a side note on that, I was in, I guess it was Orscheln. I was in Orscheln earlier this week. And just so happened, just kind of messing around, looking around a little bit, different things. And I went over and I checked out the, the Gly and see how much that is. My God. You talk about sticker shock.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, originally I looked at that and they didn't even have a sticker made up for it. They took in Sharpie and wrote the price on every bottle.
Yep.
What cost us last year, $40 when you get it on sale for a 2-gallon bottle of it. Or I shouldn't say bottle. It's a jug, right? Two gallons a jug.
Jug.
2-gallon jug. $149.99.
Yeah, it's insane. Luckily for the both of us, I've got a lot of it left, so we'll be able to use some of that before we go and buy more. But it's insane. I mean, even if you go in the meat aisle right now, I just came from Costco not long ago, earlier this morning, and meat there it's just insane. It is insane. A beef loin, it was nearly $200. And it wasn't even an
crazy
obnoxious slab of it. I mean, it was a pretty good size loin, but it was almost $200. It's getting out of hand, you know. I mean, it makes you thankful that you're a hunter that can put that much meat in the freezer, You know, even if you take it to a processor, it's still so much cheaper than what you're seeing in the grocery store right now. I don't remember a time that was ever quite like this.
Well, it hasn't been in your lifetime, I can tell you that. And I don't recall one in my lifetime either. But it's tough times for sure. Tough times for sure. But like you said, thankfully, we can provide. Mm-hmm. You know, we country boys can survive.
Sure.
Speaking of providing, we've got a guest coming up that is absolutely stacking them up. He's doing a fantastic job. So without further ado, we're going to go ahead and get our guest on the line here, and we'll be back with you here in just a minute. Stay tuned.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Pro Talk Outdoors. We got Parker McDonald of Southern Ground on the podcast here. And Parker, I know you've got a show of your own, and I mean, gosh, you're hunting a lot of public land. You're all over the place. Most guys by this time of year are either completely transitioned out of hunting mode and kind of into off-season mode, or
well, not in the South where he's at.
Well, I mean, that's fair. That's fair.
He's a Southern man.
That's true. That's true. But I mean, what's your advice for guys that listen to this podcast that may be a bit more regionalized to the North to keep your focus deeper into a season?
Well, dude, I'll tell you. It's a hard thing to do for guys down here. We start typically, I mean, like Georgia starts, you know, a September season. Parts of Florida start, you know, in July. I mean, Florida's got crazy weird season times. I'm in Alabama, and our season starts, the earliest season starts October 1st in one of the zones that I hunt. And so from October 1st through February 10th, you can hunt. So it's a long season. It's like when you talk about a grind, like most people, probably where you guys are at, and really most of the country, around, you know, November is your rut, you know, early November is going to be your heavy rut times, and then it just kind of starts tapering down, and so people grind, do all their grinding in November. And down here, man, we get, I mean, October and November are pretty much the same. You know, we don't have a lot of ruts that happen around that time. Once you hit Thanksgiving is where it really starts to pick up in some places. But I mean, in most of Alabama, you're looking at like the rut is just now getting started right at the beginning of the new year. And so you have places, man, where you can hunt. A guy could literally follow the rut through Florida, Alabama, or Florida, Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi. If a guy wanted to do it, he could hunt the rut from July all the way through February.
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, in Florida, that's like a total different deal, right? I mean, that is
mm-hmm. Doberman with antlers, aren't they?
Well, what's the deal with that? Because like you mentioned July, that's Florida, right? They're
yeah.
Why is that? I mean, what's going on up there?
So South Florida, around like Miami area, like super far South Florida, their rut happens in the Everglades around July. July and August. And I don't really know the correct answer scientifically. I had a guy come on the show, I guess it was last summer or two summers ago, and he hunts the Everglades, and I talked to him, and he says it has to do with water levels. So the does go into their estrus in a time frame to where when they drop fawns, the water levels aren't going to be stupid high because it's wetland. You know, it's, you're talking about the Everglades and a lot of flooded stuff. And so they don't want to drop fawns in high water levels because survival rate would be low. And so they go into their cycle in July so that the fawns drop, I guess it would be kind of like early spring to late winter. But you're talking about, like their winter time is going to be, you know,
nice.
Like our summer.
Pretty nice.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Their January, February, March is going to look probably like 80 degrees most of the time. So
that makes sense. I mean, it's kind of hard to wrap your brain around how they, I mean, I don't know how that works, but.
So, okay. So on that note, let's stick with Florida deer. What's your strategy to go about a Florida deer? It has to be a little bit different than you're doing in Alabama or especially, you know, Tennessee or anywhere north of the Ohio.
Absolutely. So I don't have a ton of experience in Florida. Most of my I have hunted Florida a couple times, more central Florida, where the rut is going to be kind of December-ish time frame. I'm actually going next week. I've got a trip to Florida, North Florida, like in the Panhandle, and their rut, it should be popping pretty hard when I get there. So it really can be all over the place in Florida. But, you know, deer density in Florida is tough. Just the terrain is tough. The not necessarily difficult, but the water and swamps and flood. And then you add in the fact that it's 80 degrees a lot of the time. It's hot. And there's a whole lot of things in Florida that want to eat you.
Yeah,
too,
yeah,
so.
The snakes down there, man. There's snakes. When there's snakes, I'm out. I hate snakes.
Well, you got snakes, mosquitoes, alligators. I mean, they have flipping pythons in the Everglades. Like, just stuff that I don't really want to mess with. So my strategy for hunting that type of Florida would be don't.
I'm not going. That's what I was going to say. That'd be mine. I'm staying out.
But those guys, the guys, I've talked to several people that hunt South Florida, and they talk about like oak heads, like finding those little high ground pieces of oaks that kind of jut out into the marshes, which honestly, the way that they describe it sounds very similar to things like I hear Dan Infault talk about with Wisconsin marshes. You know, you have the islands of oaks that kind of jut out into the marshes, and that's what people are killing bucks on, you know, and that's where bucks are bedding at. So a lot of it really parallels really well with that, like, far north type stuff. So I don't have a ton of experience. What I did, I hunted Ocala National Forest, which is like central Florida, and I got into a spot in there. And another interesting thing about Florida is dog hunting is pretty prevalent on a lot of the national forests and WMAs. So people run dogs and do all that stuff. So you fight with a lot of that pressure. But the thing that I found was these gallberry bushes are just, they grow up and they're just impenetrable thick, like just nasty, thick stuff. And the deer will live in them because the dogs don't really penetrate them that well. They don't have a lot of ability to move around. The dogs don't in those gallberry thickets. And so I found the edge of this gallberry thicket that emptied out into a palmetto flat. And I ended up seeing, I hunted there for probably 5 days, 6 days, a couple of years back. And I think one day I saw like 14 deer. I saw a ton of deer that day. But every single day I saw five or more deer just hunting that hard edge, finding the places where the dogs really couldn't get into. And that's where the, I mean, when I say there's people dog hunting out there, I mean, literally you're driving down the road, this public road, and you'll have a big, huge jacked up pickup truck with five guys drinking Natty Lights with orange vests on that are three sizes too small, with guns hanging out the window, ready for a dog to run a deer across the freaking forest road. Like, the Forest Service road that you're driving on, that people are driving on.
Wow.
You know, it's a culture shock, man. It's weird. I've heard it's fun. I've heard people who do it, they love it. They say it's a good time, but I don't know. Not for me.
Yeah,
not.
To each their own, I guess.
Yeah, I was going to say, not for me.
Well, man, tell us a little bit about the season you're having. Cause we're friends on Facebook, you know, and I follow along with what you're doing and stuff. Man, it looks to me like you're freaking ricking the deer up like firewood, man. I mean, it's just like every day I get on Facebook, you're killing another buck on public ground somewhere, and it seems like there's always water involved.
Yeah, so I do really enjoy the water access stuff, and a lot, most of the time, when I look at a new place to hunt in a state, I'm going to look at somewhere that has water access. And a lot of that's just because, like, people know these days, people know water access exists. You know, it's not a secret anymore. There's plenty of content out there now about it. The problem is that people will try it one time and they realize there's a lot of work involved. there's, you know, there's things that you don't really think about. Like, I took Mark Kenyon. I don't know if y'all know Mark Kenyon from Wired to Hunt.
Yeah.
He came down to Alabama a couple weeks ago and did a hunt with me. And things that I just kind of am used to by now, he was like, this is insane. So the fog on the water early in the morning when it's still dark, I mean, it like made him nauseated. Like, he felt like he was just going around in circles. He couldn't see anywhere he was going. So people see that, they do that, they try it once, and then they do that, and they're like, nah, I'd rather just walk in somewhere.
Well,
and
isn't it amazing to do that, though? I did it in Illinois this year for the first time. I'd done water access from a small watershed lake here, but I was on a pretty decent-sized river in Pike County, Illinois, and the fog and all the variables. I mean, we were dodging debris as we went down the river in a rubber boat, but the thing that I brought away from the whole thing was that was just badass. Like, after doing it, it's addicting.
Oh, yeah, dude. I freaking love it. I love every part of it. It's an adventure hunt, that, and the way I do it, I mean, I literally will do it every day that I hunt here in Alabama. I pretty much don't ever walk in anywhere. And you get used to it. Like, it starts to become normal. You know, it's like anything. You lift weights long enough, or you do CrossFit long enough, or you work out long enough, whatever. You know, at first it's hard, and then it just becomes normal. You start getting used to it. It doesn't mean it's less hard. It just means you kind of just raise the bar up for yourself a little bit. And so I remember the first couple times I did it, and I mostly use a kayak. But y'all might have overheard me talking to my son a while ago before we started recording. I'm actually going to buy a boat today. I'll still use the kayak because it's very versatile, but there's places I need to get into with a real boat. So,
what kind of boat you getting?
It's a weld built boat. It's like a duck boat type style, all weld with a, 20 horse Tohatsu, motor on it.
There you go.
So,
good stump jumper right there, man. Get back in there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can get back into some places. I really wanted to get it before this trip to Florida because I'll need it. But yeah, like I said, like the kayak thing, I've been doing that for now nearly 7 years exclusively and just kind of backdooring these public pieces with that. And so I shot a buck last week on Christmas Day at my dad's property in Texas, and he's got it like set up, man. He's got big, nice blinds set up. It's not Texas style hunting like you would imagine. It's not like Senderos and brush country. It's East Texas, so it looks more like Louisiana. Swampy, hardwoods, tall trees, you know, stuff like that. So, but he kept saying like, man, I think you need to get your saddle and go hunt this spot because I think that, and I'm like, I just kind of want to just sit in the blind. Like, that sounds like a lot of fun to me right now, just to relax. I've been going hard at it all season using the saddle and water access. I just kind of rather just climb up somewhere and sit down and turn the heater on. And it ended up paying off. I shot a pretty decent buck on Christmas Day.
Yeah, it was a good one for sure. So are you pretty much now, would you say you're pretty much 100% of the time using a saddle? I mean, do you hunt out of any lock-ons or climbing stands at all?
No. So this year I've shot a deer out of a lock-on tree stand and in Kentucky, and I shot one buck out of a shooting house in Texas. But those were all, you know, the one in Kentucky was just kind of it's a long story in itself, but I ended up going and hunting a buddy's property on the last day, and he had a lock-on set up there, and it was really weird. It was awkward. I hated it. I hate it. Like, when you get so used to using a certain system and then it gets kind of changed, like, that one was really, it was obvious to me that I was not in lock-on shape. I was in saddle shape. And
I'm going to need you to elaborate that a little bit there, because to me, it seems like I've never hunted out of a saddle, so full disclosure there. But to me, it almost seems like a saddle would be kind of like sitting on one of those little dove stools. that you go hunt out of, you know, or you sit on the edge of a field, and then a lock-on would be like sitting in my Lazy Boy recliner, comparatively speaking.
Oh, so man.
How am I wrong there?
Not at all. There's a couple things about a saddle, is that the line, your tether that has you attached to the tree is always tight. So you always have that security of, I'm not going to fall. I could literally walk all the way around this tree, and I'm not going to fall. With the lock on, dude, I was like kind of freaking out. I was like, if I make one wrong step, I had a safety harness on. Actually, I had my saddle on as a safety harness.
There you go.
Because I don't own a safety harness anymore, because I don't ever hunt out of that kind of stuff. So I had my saddle on, and I had the bridge of the saddle behind me, like pulled behind my back, and then the tether tied on. And so, but I was like, when I stood up, and it was a big freaking lock on too. But when I stood up, I was just like, I felt so insecure. The saddle, and also the other thing you got to think about for me is I'm filming everything. And so my whole film setup changed, because now I'm sitting face away from the tree, and usually I'm sitting faced at the tree. And so just everything was opposite for me. And it looked like a cluster with me getting up there, getting up into that tree stand, because I just hadn't done it in a long time. And I know it sounds dumb. Like, for a lot of people, it sounds dumb. But really, for me, I don't have a lot of private places to hunt where I could even set up a lock-on or a ladder stand or anything like that. I have no private places in Alabama. Really, the only private land that I get to hunt much is when I go to Texas and visit my family, and which is usually maybe once a year. And so, I mean, all year long, I am using the saddle when I hunt public land here in Alabama. And so I'm a systems guy whenever it comes to hunting, and really that's about the only thing that I'm a systems guy in. But when you mess up my system, it throws me off for the rest of the day. Like, I just...
Yeah, I get that.
I struggle.
I get that. So, when you're hunting, so almost entirely public ground. Mm-hmm. Do you find it a challenge? I mean, with the other hunters, are you around a lot of other guys, or are you just basically using the water to access deeper points where most guys can't get to? Or, you know, what are you looking at whenever you go to a new public piece of ground?
Yeah. So, like I said, most people, there's really anywhere that I've ever been, with the exception of one place that is entirely water access. So the only people that are going to be out there are water access guys. And that's a place in North Alabama. And that hunt, that specific hunt only happens, they only open it up like 9 days out of the whole season. So for those 9 days, all the water access guys are there. And it's a really good hunt. But there's a lot of pressure. So take that place out, and really everywhere I go. In Kentucky, most of the time I'm the only person at the boat ramp. In Alabama, where I hunt at home, there are people who, and I want to say this in a wise way, because I don't want to sound like a douche, but there's people who watch my videos, listen to my podcast, and they go in and they see the success that I have.
Oh, I get that 100%. Yeah.
And they go in and there's one group of about three or four guys that went around telling everybody earlier this season that they were bragging to all their friends, oh, we're going to kill so many deer because we're going to be hunting all Parker's spots. We got trail cameras put up in all his spots, blah, 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 blah. As far as I know, those guys haven't killed a deer yet, but a lot of it, people think they're looking for an easy way to kill deer on public land, and
there's no such thing, is there?
Yeah, that doesn't exist. Like, if you're not learning, like a guy who's going to go out and try to find where I hunted at to kill a deer, he's watching one video that I posted. He doesn't realize that I'm hunting 5 days a week, and I go out there and I kill a buck maybe one day out of 10, You know what I mean? Like,
so,
he's not,
you know, patience
the rest
is a huge virtue whenever you're doing what you're doing, I'm sure. I mean, it's one thing to
it's
important in any style of hunting, but, you know, especially I think it gets amplified a great deal whenever you're talking about hunting public. And I know, you know, I said on our last podcast that, you know, Parker, I've been hunting for 33 years now. Yeah, 33 years I've been deer hunting. And I have hunted, excluding like special military refuge hunts, you know, special draw hunts that you get here in Indiana, excluding those, I've hunted less than 5 times on public ground for deer in my life. That is, I mean, it's like, it's total polar opposite of what you're doing. And I just find it fascinating that you're able to have the success that you're having.
Well, and a lot, like I said, man, a lot of it is like, I'm a student of whitetails. Like, anytime I see a deer, if I'm on the side of the road, just driving the highway or something like that, like, I want to know, why is there always a dead deer on this part of the highway? Or why do I see a deer
hit by a
here?
Car?
Exactly.
He wants to know why he crossed the road, Dave. Why did the chicken cross the road?
Look, I know. Just, I was being a smart butt for a second there. I know.
That, but yeah, so like, I'm always trying to figure out, like, why is that deer, why is there always seem to be deer in this one area? So I'll pull up my maps and look and try to figure out why, and then try to come up with these, you know, consistencies that I find based on my time in the tree, where I see deer at, you know, and so I have, you know, kind of a system there that I live by whenever it comes to that. But these guys looking for easy ways to do it on public land, like you said, it doesn't exist. But the people who really are studying and they're spending time and they're going out there and they're, you know, you might get discouraged, but you're not giving up. That's what kills deer. It's not going to be that you found somebody else's honey hole, because if you found somebody else's honey hole, that now means there's twice the amount of pressure on that honey hole. So it's not a honey hole anymore. And so, you know, this year, one of the things that I did because of these guys that have kind of figured out the areas that I hunt, I started a thing called New Spot Mondays, and I did that in the early season. And what I would do on those New Spot Mondays is I would just go, I mean, it's pretty simple. I'd go and find a new place, and a place that maybe I've had marked that I've never been to, and just see what it was. And if it halfway looked decent, I would start trying to break it down throughout that the rest of that week. Cause early season in Alabama is really on public land, like big woods type stuff, is really tough. I hunted, like I said, probably 5 days a week from October through November, and I saw 2 bucks in that entire time frame. One was a small 6-point and one was a spike. So I wasn't seeing a lot of bucks. So I was just kind of challenging myself to get prepared for, you know, the pre-rut, rut, and then post-rut. And those New Spot Mondays, I mean, 2 of the bucks that I killed in spots that I'd never even seen a deer before, ever. And then one of the deer that I killed him the first time I went into that spot this season. And so I think stuff like that really helped me, kind of getting out of my comfort zone, getting out of the areas that would be quote unquote honey holes every year, always producers. And like you said, for 3 weeks in December, I killed a buck every week. From December, I killed one December 1st. I killed a buck December the 7th or 8th, on December the 8th. Then I killed one on December the 13th. And that was my final tag in Alabama. And a lot of that came from literally just going into new places, avoiding the pressure of those other guys who had. And when I say pressure, you're not talking about like 10 trucks at one trailhead. I'm talking about like one guy who might be in there on Saturday and Sunday, but to me, that's enough pressure to say,
that's enough to screw it up. That's enough to move things around for sure.
So, I mean, obviously, you've got programs like Onyx or comparable Hunt Stand, you know, different things that show you land and topography, and you know, you're able to find water and things of that nature. outside of using those, or I guess in addition, not outside, in addition to using those, how does somebody go about getting started to thinking outside the box? Does it start in, you know, June, July, going in there and trying to walk it? Or how do you break it down for the first time to identify what it is you think you may target?
Well, so the number one thing that I'm looking for is landlocked, right? Which you can never, when you're talking about landlocked areas, you're talking about areas that can still probably be accessed by somebody from those private land areas, right? So, like, I've got one spot that right across the private, right across the boundary line, there's a food plot and a shooting house or deer blind set up on that food plot. So people, you're never going to get a place that is, I say never, you're rarely going to find a place that is 100% not hunted by anybody else. So, but I do want places that are 100% not accessible by foot for the public. And so during the summertime, off season, typically it's turkey season for me is when I do most of my scouting. But there's nothing more annoying to me than going to a new spot only to find that even though the map said there wasn't walk-in access, there actually was. Because you do all the work to get back there by boat, and then you get there and you find out
you could have parked 100 yards away and walked in.
Exactly. And that's happened before to me when I was being careless, or like late season stuff when, you know, I was just trying to fill another tag and I wasn't really focused on my full process. But during turkey season, what I'll do is I'll go and as I'm turkey hunting, walking around, running gun style, stuff, I'll walk these property lines and just make sure there's no way that anybody else could ever walk in. And if there is a way, I want to make sure that there are barriers that separate to just keep pressure to the minimum. So, for example, when I say barriers, there's one spot that I have that I can hunt, that I hunt a lot, actually. And there's a parking area, and from a map perspective, it looks like, you know, that parking area is probably only a mile away from this, which is plenty far. So that's one barrier. A mile is a pretty decent barrier. But in between the parking area and the place that I hunt, there's two different, like, straight down bluffs that somebody would have to climb to get to where I'm at. They would have to, I mean, it would be so much work to get back there.
And they're probably not getting a deer out of there.
No. So. No, they're going to be, most people think in terms of, okay, can I get back there? And then number two, if I shoot a deer, can I get it out? They're thinking in that term. And I never think in that term. I never think of, can I get a deer out of here? Like, I'll worry about that crap whenever I get there. We'll figure out a way to get the deer out. But most people are going to think in terms of, can I get a deer out? And that
most people, because well, that's exactly the way I think.
Now, obviously, you access a lot of these by water, like you said. Is that your method of extraction typically, or do some of these properties, you know, these public lands, do they allow a four-wheeler or something of that nature?
Most of them will not allow four-wheelers. There's a few WMAs in the state that will let you go and retrieve an animal that way. But for the most part, four-wheelers are going to be limited to the same things that vehicles are. So if it's a no-motor trail, then it's a no-motor trail. You have to figure out a way. But what I do, I'll drag, if it's, you know, less than, let's say 600 yards and less, I'll probably just drag it out and just suffer through that. But I also carry a frame pack. All my stuff is in a frame pack, and I carry game bags. So if I get into a spot where it's just going to be too much to drag it out, I'll just quarter it up and pack it out right there. And I've done that a couple times too. And I set up for my entire setup is to work no matter where I'm at. And I always carry that frame pack. It carries all my camera gear, all my saddle hunting stuff. So if I need to use it to pack out a deer, I've always got it.
Well, it's working, brother. It's absolutely working. We love watching what you're doing, and and all the success you're having out there, and you're having a great year, no doubt. So, man, tell us, tell our listeners how they can keep up with everything that you're doing, podcast wise, YouTube channel. You know what you get. You know where they can follow and see how they can learn a little bit from you on how to kill some of these public land deer.
Sure. So I appreciate that, and thank you guys for having me on. We are a part. I'm part of the Sportsman's Nation network, just like you guys are. So if somebody listens to Pro Talk on the Whitetail feed, the Sportsman's Nation feed, then you can find my stuff right there. If not, you can just search Southern Ground Hunting on any podcast platform, and you find it there. YouTube channel, you just search Southern Ground Hunting. You'll see some stuff on there. I've had an incredibly blessed season, specifically in the last month. It's been just way better than I deserve, and it's been such a fun season. But that being said, I'm also, it's hard to hunt and edit video at the same time, and so I'm trying to catch up right now in between, you know, Christmas and this Florida trip I've got coming up. I'm trying to edit as much video as I possibly can, but I still got a couple more to go. But you can see anything from, I've got North Dakota. I hunted North Dakota earlier this season, Kentucky during November, and Alabama in December. So there's plenty of stuff from this season. And then seasons past, you know, I've got probably 4 or 5 seasons worth of stuff on there. So you can check us out there on Facebook and Instagram. It's at Southern Ground Hunting. And I also do post a lot of stuff on Go Wild. Going to be working a lot with the Go Wild guys and their team this year. Posting some content there exclusively for Go Wild, so that'd be pretty cool. But you can just search my name, Parker McDonald, on Go Wild and find all that stuff there.
Awesome, thanks, brother. Man, I tell you, keep up the good work, man. We, I was telling JP, I was like, dude, Parker McDonald's on a roll. We need to talk to this guy and get him on a podcast, because, like I said, I wasn't kidding, man. You're literally stacking them up like you're ricking firewood with these deer, man. It's pretty impressive. So.
It sets a standard, man, like that. I this is the way that I do things. Like I hunt hard and I spend a lot of time in the woods, and my career allows for it. I can really, you know, kind of be flexible in that. So, but it sets this like standard where it's like, well, next year, if I don't do it, then everybody's just gonna think I got lucky this year. And so, it's been, like I said, it's been a blessing, and, it's been a whole lot of fun to just, you know, just kind of live in this moment. And it, you know, it's the thing that you think about. If you're a hardcore deer hunter, you think about it all 365 days a year, and I'm kind of getting to live into this dream right now. And so it's been a whole lot of fun, but it definitely, I can't tell you that those thoughts don't creep in every once in a while, like, yeah, you're just lucky. You're just a lucky son of a gun.
you make your own luck in this world. Parker, we appreciate you so much, man, and hang with us through the break. You're listening to Pro Talk Outdoors. You want to talk about an interview that just makes you feel bad about yourself.
Yeah.
I just left feeling like, man.
I don't know about, yeah.
Man.
Made me feel lazy. You know,
I mean, and I'm like not a lazy person at all. I pride myself on that, but he definitely hunts harder than me.
Well, you know what? I'll say this: we do our work in a different manner. Ours is a lot. We probably do more prep work than what he does.
Sure,
but you know, our prep work, you know, is food plotting and, you know, all that good stuff, land management kind of stuff, because we're hunting private. You know, we're hunting stuff that we can control a little bit, and Parker's hunting stuff that we all own, you know, public ground.
It's almost like a different sport in a way. I mean, I don't want to say that it is, but it's, I mean, it's almost, I don't know. It's just different. It's like ping pong to table tennis, kind of. That's probably not the best analogy, but you get what I'm suggesting.
I do, man. And if you,
it's
if
the
you
same,
honestly
but different.
Take a, if a guy that's like us and hunts, you know, 99.9% private ground, and you take a step back and you're honest with yourself about this, us same guys, we could transport ourselves into the public land realm and, mm-hmm. and just say we're going to hunt 100% public, and I guarantee you most of us are going to struggle mightily. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a total different deal. I mean, we don't have, you know, on public ground, you don't have the food plots to take advantage of. You know, you can't manage the land, and you don't have it to yourself. You got all kinds of other interferences. So it's like it just amplifies the entire game, makes the difficulty level go to a 10 versus about a 2 in what we're dealing with.
Sure. Absolutely. He's having an impressive season and just impressive all the way around. So my hat's off to him. Not to mention, I think hunting a lot of the states that he hunts are different in and of themselves as well.
Oh, yeah. I got zero interest in going to Florida ever to hunt. I don't like going to Florida anyway.
Fishing? I want to go fishing
If I'm going bass fishing, you know, yeah, I'm good with that. But
tarpon, I'd like to do that.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, man, the state in itself.
Marlin?
I mean, no disrespect. Okay, there's a lot of stuff I'd like to catch in Florida. You know,
there's probably also some things you wouldn't want to catch in Florida.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't want to get caught in Florida either by those snakes. And I mean, they got pythons, for Christ's sake. I mean, jeez.
Yeah, that stuff there, that's just not for me. It's not. Before we close this thing out, I want to publicly give you some credit for some hard work you've been doing land management-wise this week. You've dropped more trees than a beaver this week. I mean, you have absolutely been bringing them
down.
Man,
I tell you what, it looks like a tornado done went through my woods out here. I bought a new chainsaw and got it all tuned up, ready to go, and I just, you know, I took to the woods. You know, I talked a while back and a few podcasts ago about the forester coming out and looking at everything. We identified what trees need to come out to do some TSI, timber stand improvement, and man, went to work. And I'm not even close to being done. I got a lot of trees I want to still bring down, but I'm kind of torn a little bit. I'd like to get your thought on this.
Sure.
a lot of the tree species that I'm bringing down is river birch. River birch is not very rot resistant, so they're going to decay fairly fast. They're not good quality as far as firewood goes, so I'm not going to cut it to burn in my wood stove. I mean, I'm sure they'd be good for campfire or bonfire or something like that. But yeah. So all that being considered, with all these trees that I'm dropping here, would you leave them suckers lay? Or would you take the time to cut them up and bring them out? Well, I mean,
I think it depends. I know just in my past experience, the last few years, hunting some places that had some thicker tornadic type areas that had a lot of just blowdowns, that tends to create some good bedding. Now, I know they rot quickly, but, I mean, rotting quickly doesn't mean overnight. You know, that's the course of a year or two. You know, it's going to take to really completely get all nasty and goopy and gone. If you dropped several of those on top of one another the way that picture looked, I think you could feasibly create some temporary bedding habitat. I would leave it.
Yeah, that's my thought right now, and especially with given the fact that I'm opening up the canopy so much mm-hmm. that I do expect to get some good ground cover, you know, get some, you know, generate some growth with the understory a little bit, and maybe make it a little bit more advantageous to the deer to stay on our property, because we're going to have plenty of food. We've mm-hmm. got great food we've talked about on the podcast here. The one thing we kind of lack on our property here is cover, and by creating a tornadic looking jungle out here, I think we're going to have plenty of cover.
Right. Not to mention, you know, the year two, whatever, for them to completely rot away, that's going to give some cover in the meantime while that undergrowth comes up and takes its place. I don't know. That's probably the strategy I would take. I could be completely full of crap, though.
Yeah. Well, I didn't want to seem like I was lazy if I just left it looking like that, but I think I'm going to leave it.
You know, if nothing else, that can also create some landmarks and some obstruction. If nothing else, you could divert traffic as a result of that, too. If it's thick enough in there, they may go around it. You never know.
Yeah, could very well. Could very well. I mean, it's interesting. It's going to be a lot of fun seeing what kind of opportunities it brings to the property here. And man, I've just really enjoyed being a land manager.
Absolutely.
We're gonna have plenty of real world food plots over here. We talked earlier about I'm gonna have some clover and chicory and some Gen 2 soybeans over here, and then gonna have some ag also, so plenty of food.
Oh, no doubt. I'm looking forward to kind of revamping the attack on our place as well. And I just got the barn finished finally on hanging board inside OSB, so I wanted to basically box in all of my insulation everywhere, and I'm still waiting on overhead doors, so, you know, that's a struggle, but I'm ready to do more land management and less home and barn management, so I'm hoping I can transition soon.
I tell you what, man, it's nice to have this problem.
Yeah, for sure.
A property owner's work is never done.
No.
Never done.
It's just a constant prioritization. But with that said, hope you guys enjoyed the episode. And
this is the last one we're recording in 2021. So it's going to come in 2022. It'll be the first one you hear from us, you know, when it gets released. But, yeah, it's been a good year. We haven't done a lot of podcasts this year.
No.
But you're going to ramp that up and get more consistent in 2022. We got plenty of stuff to bullcrap about. We're pretty good at that anyway.
Yeah. That's true. It's a blessing and a curse. Hope you guys have enjoyed it. Until next time, hook 'em or hunt 'em. Pro Talk Outdoors.
Later, guys.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.